In this video, we are going to be talking about the classic film noir from 1953, which was directed and co-written by the great filmmaker Samuel Fuller, Pick Up on South Street, and it starred Richard Widmark, Gene Peters, and Thelma Ritter. And my guest today, I want to welcome back Trillo and Suede, the film noir detectives. They have a great television series, web series, which you can find on YouTube. And they just shot Casa Noir, which is a short film of their life working together as detectives. So Trillo, Suede, welcome back.
Thank you, Robert. It's nice to be back here. We had a lot of fun the last time. We sure did.
Yeah,
so we're looking forward to returning.
No, thanks so much, guys. I was really looking forward to this. So I know we all had a busy summer and we were trying to plan this. So finally we were able to get back into this one. So I want to ask you both individually. I think we touched on Pick Up on South Street when we spoke in June. What do you guys think of this film?
Well, it was a lot of fun, especially because we're very partial to New York City noir. You know, because it's our hometown, and it's really cool to see the old photography in the old streets of New York, and very nostalgic. I think I can speak for Trillo in this.
Yes, you can speak for me.
God knows he speaks for me a lot.
So something that we particularly latched onto, and I think it was done really well, is capturing the grittiness of the city, and even from the opening shot on the subway, you know, that was a great metaphor, I think. It was opening up on the shot of the subway and then inside the subway, because it's kind of the shakiness, the crowded, you know, the fact that it's both shaky and crowded in there, impersonal, and nobody's talking. It's all silence in there. There's an ominous feeling in the air, so it sets the pace for it. So I think that's something that goes throughout the movie, this kind of intensity. The way it's shot also, like there are slow zooms several crucial times that creates this intensity. So I'd say this feeling of intensity is what particularly, I'd say if I had to choose the best thing about it, what would you say?
Well, for me, the best thing about it was Candy. She was hot as hell.
Yeah, well, okay, I won't deny that.
Oh, come on. She was smoking up the screen there.
Well, I remember I asked both of you guys last time who your favorite femme fatale was, and I heard you both really love Gene Peters. So what is it about Gene Peters that you like so much?
Yeah, well, you know, she's got this kind of streetwise personality. I mean, you know, she knows the score, but she's, so it's not... But she's not typical kind of femme fatale, a little different
right.
Twist on that. But the main thing, she's smoking hot.
Yeah, okay, yeah, she's definitely, okay, so she's attractive.
Just attractive, that's all you got to say?
Well, what do you want me to say? I mean, she's attractive.
Yeah, just attractive.
He's trying to keep it clean, maybe.
Yeah, I don't want to keep things in perspective. Anyway, yeah, well, okay, yeah, she's certainly very, very alluring. I think it's kind of, I felt sad how she falls for Skip McCoy, you know, especially, I mean, think that he knocks her out. I mean, doesn't know who she is at first, but even then when he sees her, that identifies it with her own flashlight, he picks up, and then he laughs. I mean, this really sets us up to really, really hate him, you know. Of course, then we see another side to him a little later, but and then he wakes her up by pouring beer on her face. I mean, like, what could get more of a kind of an asshole move like that?
No, I think he's a cool dude.
Cool.
Yeah, well, I mean, like, yeah, okay, he's rough and tumble and all that, but you know, look how she falls for him for a reason, because they kind of gravitate to each other. You know, she knows the deal. Yeah, so I think he's he's kind of the cool guy. Look, he's a lot smarter than the cops, especially that guy, Detective Tiger.
That's true.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, but Detective Tiger has a personal issue, you know, with McCoy because of their history, because, you know, McCoy got him docked 6 months of salary. That's a very personal issue. Well, whose fault is that? Because Detective Tiger's such a wuss. I mean, so McCoy, he marked the floor with that guy. Yeah, well, I think you're
I
a little bit.
I can see where both of your sympathies lie in this film.
Like, yeah, I mean, you know, you got to understand. I mean, he's Detective Tiger is a sympathetic kind of character.
Yeah, if you're another wuss.
Okay, but, you know, so I found a kind of a soft spot for him.
Yeah, you would.
Well, anyway.
You guys see him as the anti-hero, Skip?
I don't know. I kind of, I thought, yeah, you know, he's got these two sides. We see him later on. But as far as, I got to tell you something about, you see Trillo's reaction about getting upset because they fall for each other, you know, Candy and Skip. But that's because Trillo's jealous of me. You know, we need all these hot dames in our line of work, you know, clients, suspects, and witnesses and stuff. And invariably, they fall for me, not him. So
I remember that. Yeah, I remember that so well. And just recently, I know you both shot Kazan Noir, this short film. Was that happening again, Suede? Were you getting a lot of the women and Trillo was getting jealous?
Well, no exception, and that's just the way it rolls there. I mean, look, Trillo, he's not a bad-looking guy, I'll give him that, and sometimes, you know, he gets a little action, but they invariably wake up and they go back to me if they give him a fling or something. It happened a couple of times. In season one of the web series, there was Chloe Cliché, and, you know, she did have a little fling with him. Then she came to her senses, came back to me. And the same pattern happened with Fiona Fatale in season two. So it is something, you know, he takes kind of, he's a little sensitive about that. But, you know, I'll give him this, Trillo, he's sometimes because he doesn't get so worked up in this. I mean, because he's by himself so much, you know, he's so isolated. He gives him time to do a lot of thinking. And that's why we're a good team, because sometimes I do get distracted. I'll cop to that. I'll admit to that. But and Trillo's, he kind of pulls me back into the scene, you know, into the thinking, into what we need to do, because he's got all this time on his hands and he kind of obsesses about things. And sometimes because of that, yeah.
Is it difficult to patch things up when all these beautiful women are coming between the two of you?
Yeah, well, sometimes there is a lot of tension between us, but we have business to take care of, and, you know, we ultimately get back to that, and I give him credit because he uses his time productively, because he does a lot of thinking about what's going on in the cases. Sometimes he'll come up with angles that I missed, because I can be a little sloppy, I'll admit to that, because...
Well, with all those beautiful women flirting with you, yeah. I can understand.
Yeah, that's the issue, yeah. So anyway, it all works out in the end. That's why we're still partners, even though, you know, he's a pain in the ass. And you might think the same thing about me.
Okay, yeah, well, I certainly do. But it's true, we do. As a detective team, I think we can't be beat. So that's why we're still in this together after all that. But ultimately, I just want to mention that we do have to see a client in a couple of minutes.
Yeah, right. I don't want to miss her. But we got an appointment at the last exit.
Yeah, I don't want to keep you. I don't want to keep you guys. So
yeah,
I know you got Jonathan in the wings.
Yeah, I know.
So I could talk to him more about pickup on South Street.
Crazy
fan. Go ahead.
No, sorry. I just want to. You wanted to say something about the end of the movie, huh?
Yeah, I just want to say that I found the it was a very gripping movie all along, except the ending to me was a little disappointing. It's certainly not the typical film noir ending on a dark note kind of thing.
Right.
It was an uppy ending. And I thought it sort of took away a little bit from it because, you know, I think a little bit more of a dour sort of... a gloomy, less happy ending would be in keeping more of the spirit of film noir in general, and I think of even of the film.
I think the ending was perfect.
I agree.
Yeah, I think
it's on that one. I love the ending.
Yeah, I think it you know, who says you got to always be the same thing? It's cliche, you know, for film noir.
That's true.
Just right.
And but, actually, you know, there are a number of film noirs that have happy endings. The Big Heat comes to mind, also ends on a good note.
Yeah, it's just not the stereotypical type of ending that we think of. But yeah, it's not the only one. I thought it just, it ended just right. Look, I'm not surprised by Trillo because it reflects his gloomy personality.
Okay, anyway, I think we better go to our meeting.
So, I had a feeling that you would say that, Slade.
Yeah, well, yeah, so
you guys gotta get going. All right, I won't keep you, but thanks so much for stopping by. I appreciate you letting me know what you think of Pickup on South Street, and I look forward to seeing Kazanor. Keep me posted.
Yeah, we're gonna do that, and I think we're our fan. We got this crazed, deranged fan named Jonathan Geffner.
Right.
And I think he's hanging out there. He wants to talk to you. So we'll come back in a minute. Okay, right. We'll bring Jonathan. Nice
all
to
right,
see you again,
Robert. Hey, guys. We'll see you soon. There he is, Jonathan.
Hi.
Wow, those guys are a lot to handle.
Yes, they are. I brought that burden upon myself when I created them. Of course, they think they created me, I believe. But however it is, they are definitely a big part of my life now.
Oh, yes. No, absolutely. I appreciated both of their take on Pickup on South Street, and I wanted to get into it much more in depth with you. So what do you think of this film?
Yeah, I think it's a great one. I think it works on many different levels. Similar to what Trillo and Swade said, oddly, I kind of agree with them that in particular to the New York City noirs, because it's a personal, like sentimental thing. I think that New York City is the perfect, in the sort of quintessential environment, even though it's the minority of the film noirs, because the majority of them are West Coast,
that's
LA
right.
Based, yeah. You know. And of course, a lot of great ones that were shot in California and set there. But I think New York City is the quintessential environment for it because of the claustrophobia, the crowdedness, and the feeling of isolation within the crowds. I think that lends itself perfectly to the spirit of film noir. You know, that spirit can be created any place, and it often is. In Double Indemnity and the other great ones that are LA based, so they create that feeling. But the feeling is intensified if the setting is New York City, because that already has that feeling of gloom, or it lends itself easily to that kind of because of the fact that it's so crowded, and the skyscrapers give that feeling of impending kind of doom and claustrophobia and all that. So I love the environment.
That's a good point. I hadn't thought of it that way, because they're often amongst crowds. You know, you see the subway or even that big fight towards the end, but Skip and Thelma Ritter and Gene Peters, all these characters, they live outside the law. They're trying to just get by. It's these thieves, basically these criminals. They're told with the utmost empathy from Samuel Fuller. I mean, you totally empathize with them, even though, well, not so much the communists, but the other characters are they have a lot of brutality to them. And you know, what's interesting about this film is that it's very heavy on plot, where, you know, you're connecting the dots in a simple way, but where would you say the heart of the film lies?
Oh, I think ultimately the heart of the film, I would say the soul of the film, is Mo Williams. You know, is she to me?
Oh yeah,
yeah. Because
so good, Thelma Ritter, man, wow.
Yeah, she plays it perfectly and beautifully, and you know, the like there are the characters, as you said or alluded to, are you know, they're mixed. We at least eventually sympathize. Because Skip McCoy first. Is just this two-bit grifter who is, you know, leering and very unlikable. Then gradually we do see that other side to him, and especially when Mo dies, and we see that he goes out of his way to get her that funeral that she had longed for and had referenced several times before that. That was sort of heartbreakingly, the only thing she was living for is to have a good funeral, you know, and she wasn't going to get it because of the way her life was taken so abruptly before she had enough money for it. So she was going to be taken to Potter's Field and, you know, where paupers are buried, and he intervenes. And, you know, so he really goes out of his way and presumably out of his own pocket, he's going to get her the funeral. He says,
I really love that moment. And the irony is that the whole reason he's in this mess is because she fingered him. But there's this, but there's this really beautiful understanding. I love that scene they have at the bar where, you know, because when I first saw this, I thought, you know, he's going to want to kill this woman. But there's this beautiful understanding that they've known each other since Skip was a kid. And clearly she's a much older woman, and that she does what she needs to do to get by, and he does what he needs to do to get by. That they basically live on the same street, so to speak. That they're both, you know, petty criminals. She trades information, sells information, and he steals and he pickpockets. And as she put it, you know, I'm just giving them a shortcut to you or to someone else. They're going to get to you anyways.
Yeah, right.
And exactly. I love that. There's no hard feelings, you know. This is just a total understanding. It's almost like she was his mother.
Right. He accepts that. And when she first said that to the cops, he'll understand. And I was expecting he's not going to react that way, but then he does. She predicted also that he would want to know that they got a good price for, they had to pay a good price for that. Like his status as a criminal was reflected by how much money the cops had to bribe her, you know, to get the information.
I love that.
That was cute.
And that, you know, she got an Academy Award nomination for this, and that beautiful monologue she has right before she's killed by Candy's ex-boyfriend, who's this, you know,
Joey,
yeah. This communist who's after Skip. And, you know, it's interesting that she'll trade information, she'll sell information, but if it's for a communist, she won't do that, because that's just
draws the line there. Yeah.
It draws the line for a communist. And that scene is so sad where she, you know, he has a gun to her and she's home and you see she lives in this tiny shack, and basically saying you'll be doing me a favor by killing me, because, you know, she's getting old, she's tired, and how is she gonna, you know, this is a difficult, you know, rat race for anyone, and, you know, she's a woman in her 50s at this point. So again, you know, Fuller just told this story with the utmost empathy for characters that people would not want to know in life. I you know, it's really interesting.
Yeah, exactly. That's why when you ask me, to me, it's a no-brainer that her character is the heart of the movie, because even though we do have sympathy for McCoy, you know, especially at that point and later in the film, and certainly we have sympathy for Candy. She's, you know, a dupe in the stealing of the film in the first place, has no idea that's what is being asked of her. And she's a sympathetic character, but Mo's character is really just so heart-wrenching, because she, you know, later in life, she's lost all hopes. Her dreams, her goals have just been lowered to the point of living only to get money for her funeral. So it's so heartbreaking. We feel we can sense it in her personality, the way she plays the role, that she really doesn't have any mean bone in her body. She just her life has gone this way, that in order to survive, she found a way to do it. But there's still honor among thieves, and she draws lines. She won't do certain things.
Yeah, no, I love that. And, you know, it's I've always loved Thelma Ritter, you know, Miracle on 34th Street. She was in another film that's lesser known called The Incident that I love, and so many really great, you know, New York films. And she became an actor, I only read this last night, when she was in her 40s. She had two children.
Oh, really?
That she, I didn't know that. I didn't know much about her. And A Miracle on 34th Street, which is only, you know, maybe 6-7 years before this film, was her first ever film, her first ever performance. And she has that one scene, and she's always just, I don't want to say stole the scene, but she really pops out. She's so distinctive. She's so present. She's so, I mean, someone really needs to write a biography on her life, because I find that so fascinating that in the 1940s, at a time when most women, unfortunately, after 40, they could hardly get parts. You could spend Betty Davis and Joan Crawford, and she becomes an actress and goes on to get these Academy Award nominated performances in some films and unforgettable performances. I mean, she's really someone that people should, you know, everyone knows that face. Of course, you know, she was in Rear Window as another classic, but she's someone people really need to study, because I think she was a fantastic actress.
Yes, I think so too. Certainly here, she just nailed this this role amazingly. That scene right before she's killed, I took note of this, that there's one shot when she gives that speech about her life and it expresses her resignation, which is really, she's expressing what we now would call as a deep depression. She does that so beautifully. And also the camera starts off mid-shot, and then it's a very slow zoom while she does it. And it's one shot, a minute and 19 seconds. I checked that. So that's for 1 minute and 19 seconds of her speech. It's one continuous shot with a very slow zoom. And it's so powerful by the time it ends on her close-up right before she dies. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of little things in that one scene that works so beautifully. Like she turns on the phonograph near her bed right before she's confronted by Joey. And it plays this beautiful, lilting, romantic, gentle song, French, you know, song of the era. And that music, talking about, and even the lyrics, I've made some notes, see if I could even find them here, but it's a very kind of wistful and romantic song. And this is while she's giving this depressing speech, and as she's, and when she is finally killed, and then it, in fact, the last shot of the scene is, it goes over to the phonograph.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then we hear the shot, you know, so it's, it works just perfectly.
Apparently, as soon as Sam Fuller heard that song, he said, "We got to get that song. I don't care what we have to pay." And apparently it cost him nothing. It was redone by many other artists, like Frank Sinatra, for example, did a recording of that song. I forget the details. You could find, there's Eddie Mueller did a video about this film that you can find on YouTube, the TCM, the Noor Ali host. And he said, the rights to that song cost nothing. It was not a well-known song until, you know, as I said, some of these big artists re-recorded it. I find this fascinating, this relationship between Gene Peters and Richard Widmark, because it's almost hard to believe that there really is this center of a love story here between Skip and G and Candy. But, you know, the first time he sees her, he punches her right in the face. And within minutes, they're kissing, you know, they're like two magnets. There's this heat, there's this sexual attraction. And I think in their world, sex and violence just go hand in hand. And, you know, that's not the only time that was the only time he punched her. But even later on, when she comes back to give him $500 and, you know, he calls her a communist and a red, and he, you know, I tell them that I want 25 grand. I mean, he's out to get, he doesn't care who he has to deal with, communists or not. He's, this guy is not a patriot, you know, and he'll he'll do anything for as much money as he can get. But I found it so interesting how he was so intimate with her, but then the next minute pushing and shoving her, and you feel so bad for her. She's being pushed and shoved around, and this woman is full of love. I mean, even though she's broken up with Joey, this communist who she doesn't know is a communist, she wants to help him. You see that when he said, when the film gets stolen off the top, and he begs her, you know, because of her connections, clearly she works outside of the law. You don't know exactly what, and she doesn't have to do that. I mean, there's no reason for her to have to find who stole that film. It's not her responsibility. She wouldn't get in trouble. You know, nothing. I mean, they might kill her because they might just blame her because it was stolen out of her purse. But I found that so interesting that everything she did was motivated from warmth and love of these two men. And even later when, you know, Joey gets the gun to go find Skip and kill him from those other communists. In that moment, she finds out that Joey is a communist. They're cutting back and forth between their faces and there's no words. And you know what she's learning at that point. And she still says, you know, don't kill him because you're going to get the chair. So on the one hand, she doesn't want him to get the chair. And she also doesn't want Skip to get killed. So she has these feelings for both of these men. And I found that quite interesting. I don't know how you felt about that.
Yes, I wasn't sure, and I'm not, and I don't know if we are meant to know for sure what's the greater motivation in some of her actions, like you know, when she goes and tries to get that film, when, as you said, she really didn't have to, but on the other hand, she was in potential danger if she didn't. So I think both were at play, and I don't think we can really know, is it more because she was scared of Joey or more because she really you know, cared for him and didn't want him to get in trouble.
It's really up to the audience.
But she definitely she has that part of her which is clear, which she does have feelings for Joey, and then she has feelings, ultimately more feelings for Skip when she knows what's at stake and what's really behind it and all that. And then this thing about, it's very off-putting at first, as Trillo and Suede were debating also about how he brutalizes her, and then they're, you know, smooching and, you know, falling in love a few minutes later. And it's like, at first it's it's very disturbing. Well, it is disturbing.
On the other hand,
but it does make sense in their world. And also in general, I mean, how many times we see it's throughout history, and it's today too. Unfortunately, people who are in abusive relationships, I mean, usually it's the woman in an abusive relationship, although it could be the other way too. But of course, more often it's a woman who's being abused by a man, especially if it's a physical abuse. That's usually you know, men abusing women. And but it happens so often. And even people it's a kind of reminder to me that it made me think about that. And when first I thought, wait, is that believable? And I thought, well, yes, it is believable, because it's like it happens so often. People's self-esteem, even people who are rich and famous, you know, and get all kinds of accolades, adulation, and even that you read about them, like being in an abusive relationship, staying in an abusive relationship. Yeah. So the human psychology, when you have an inner issues that are not resolved of the lack of self-worth and self-esteem, fall prey to that all the time. And certainly her, it's very believable, because in her environment and background, it's something that, as you said, she surely was very used to, accustomed to.
You know, film noir, sex and violence go hand in hand, but this is a much darker. And the great irony is that Skip is, you know, the only reason at the end he beats up Joey and turns him in is not out of patriotism or out of the fact that, oh, he was appalled that this man was a communist. It was because he beat up Candy. And the other odd irony is that he also hit her, but he wouldn't hit her as badly as Joey, you know? And I mean, he put her in the hospital, you know, bruises all over. He shot her, for God's sakes. I think that repulsed him, and he obviously had a great deal of, I don't know if he was in love with her, but he had a great deal of affection for her, and ultimately wanted to, so that's why for me, he's really the anti-hero, because it's sort of like De Niro in Taxi Driver. Like, he ends up doing something so good that wasn't really his intention, all in all, like, this guy's out for a buck, that it's nothing to do with stopping communism. And I'm not sure if you read this, but, you know, the FBI director at the time, J. Edgar Hoover,
he had a talk with Fuller about that, right? Because he chastised him, you know, that for that, that it's not anti-communist enough, or
because he felt that Skip should be appalled that he's dealing with a communist, but he was still willing to get money from them. He didn't, and he even says, I don't care. And even off the top, when they you know, that the police are being rough with Skip to get the tape back. And then he says, what are you waving the flag at me? Like this guy does not care. It seems a little strange that he figured out that when he goes to the library and he looks at the film up close, and he seems to know what it is. I don't know if he necessarily knows the details of what it is, but he gets the impression it's something to do with the government. I don't know if that seems false.
Yeah, I wasn't sure about that. I think that I'm trying to remember what was my impression when he saw that, because I was frankly just confused, unsure, like, what is he figuring out from this, that it's just something top secret. I guess that to me that seemed all he could figure out, is that it looks like something that is top secret, so probably is government, but you know, yeah. I don't think he knew anything beyond that, you know.
I don't think so. And that's when he starts to, when he sees Candy after that, he starts to say, oh, you guys are a bunch of Reds. And she's sort of like, what are you talking about? So I don't know exactly how he figured that out. Maybe he, you know, here we are, early 1950s, the Red Scare and all the atomic.
Oh, wait a second. No, I'm sorry. But I think, wasn't he hauled in to the police precinct, and it was the FBI agent. I forgot his name, but there is a Detective Tiger, but then there's also the FBI guy who's now working with the police department. And I think that FBI guy says to tells him that, you know, this is stolen. It's going to be sold to the Reds, right?
That I was going to go back and check because I couldn't remember. Maybe if someone watching this comment below, I'm going to check later. But either they told him that, or he saw something in the film that he put it together.
I think, I'm not 100% sure, but I'm pretty sure he was told that that's why we're after.
It's yeah, he must have been.
They both told him, Tiger, who had it in for him, but still said, hey, I'm going along with the FBI on this one because, you know, we'll let you go. We're not going to prosecute you for the theft, for the pickpocketing, if you give us the film, because this is much more important. These are Reds who are going to get it. So he knew that. And when he's checking the film, he just wants to see, does it look like something that would be a top secret? And then, yeah, it looks like that type of thing. I
think you're right. I'm going to go back and check to see if they actually told him. But for anyone listening, feel free to let us know in the comment box. But he's such a weasel, that guy. Like he's willing to clearly he was capable of doing all this. You see him with the gun. I mean, he's quite threatening and scary.
Yeah.
And but yet he's, you know, he wanted her to take care of all this stuff, to go out and find out who did it. And you know, he gets this poor woman. My heart really went out to her. Like, he gets her to do all of his dirty work until he had to do something, until his bosses basically put a gun in his hand. And, right. You know, I think that's where, you know, obviously they, because he was a communist, they also wanted to make him look like he was the scum of the earth. And he's much, much worse than Skip. And the irony is that I think Skip would have ended up like Thelma Ritter down the road or very soon after. And by sure accident of this story, that, you know, the way in which things unfolded, Gene Peters ultimately saves him. You know, I mean, he's with her, and now he's with a woman that I don't necessarily know if they're in love with each other, but they're have a strong sexual attraction and a connection and an affection for each other. So yeah. It's optimistic to think that maybe his life will go in some other direction because he found love. I don't know. I mean, it depends on how people see it.
Yeah, you know? That's true.
Or it'll get worse for him. You know, I mean, he's been alone his whole life, and, you know, maybe he wouldn't know how to live with someone, and he already is abusive. Right. So maybe it'll be worse for her. So it's really ambiguous in that sense.
Yeah, well, we definitely don't know, but it's we definitely are left with the hope and reason to hope that maybe he actually will turn his life around now that they have found each other and have connected in some way which was real. And you know, you had thrown out earlier about whether he's actually in love with her. And I think that as much as he's capable, to the extent that he's capable of probably yeah. loving anybody, you yeah. know, because I think he's sociopathic. And, you know, so he's as a sociopath, I mean, as opposed to a psychopath, because, you know, psychopaths are defined as not being capable of love at all. They just don't have that feeling. Where sociopaths can feel love, they just are very weak in the empathy department, you know. Exactly. And so that certainly fits him. But he's capable of it, and I think in yeah. this case, he does feel something that's real for her.
No, I agree, and it, you know, it's not sentimental at all. It's not done with any form of sentimentality, which I really appreciate. But this story that we were touching on with Hoover, I'm really surprised that the head of a studio would have backed a filmmaker like Fuller, because they lost all access to using any kind of FBI headquarters or anything to do with the FBI and the ads or anything in other films that may have to do with the FBI. So the studio head, Zanuck, that was quite ballsy for him to go with a story. And I think most people, because ultimately these people are businessmen, right? But those studio heads at that time, they cared more about the content. I'm not saying they didn't care about the money, profits and all that, but they did care about the story. But this was daring. I mean, this was extremely daring to go against what Hoover wanted and to have a main character basically be totally unpatriotic and totally unlikable in this anti, and he saves the day in ways that was not his intent at all. But as a story, that's a remarkable, and has so much depth. But I think nowadays, where you have corporations running studios, they would have been like, okay, change the story.
Yeah, and that's it. No debate about it. But I wonder if it's the timing too, because I'm not sure of the timeline of McCarthyism when it was the most powerful.
Yeah, that as well. Yeah, because this was 53. So yeah, that was, you know, that was going on since the 40s, but still in the 50s, it was quite the issue, you know, quite the witch hunt, so to speak, the McCarthyism.
Right. And it was, it is kind of, it's amusing in the also the just like the stupidity of J. Edgar Hoover, not only the narrow-mindedness but the sheer stupidity of, you know, complaining that that's the character Skip McCoy is not anti-communist in principle, when that's the it's the whole point of his character, is that he doesn't care about any of this, and that's a character. I mean, for someone to confuse it with like promoting communism, when in fact the movie certainly is not promoting communism. When takes away from that, it's anti-communist. It's an anti-communist movie. It's clearly anti-communist. So the fact that J. Edgar Hoover didn't see it as such, you know, is like as if, you know, not only the movie must be anti-communist, but every character, good and bad, must be anti-communist. It's just so stupid, you know.
It is. It's as if the message had to be rammed down people's throat. I mean, you're right. It clearly is, but it's an extraordinary. Really, I've seen it at least twice in the past. So I don't think this must have been my third time. No more than three times, and I enjoyed it much more than I remember, because I think it's one of those films that offers a lot in terms of feelings and the humanism, the these people that are really interesting and have a lot of depth and range. So those are the kind of movies I like the most, the people, the characters, as opposed to something that is pure plot. Here we see a strong plot, but also strong characters.
Yeah, I agree. And I also, this was, I believe, the third time I saw it. I just watched it last night. And I had seen it twice before, years ago. And I liked it very much the first two times. I liked it even more yesterday. I was kind of blown away yesterday.
Me too.
Like, wow, it's even better than I thought. Because just the way I noticed little things about how it was filmed, the pacing of it and the cinematography, the way camera angles are used and the slow zooms and all kinds of little things. I remember, like, for example, in the cafe when Mo is meeting with him over coffee or with Skip McCoy, and you know, bringing him up to snuff with what's going on in the search for him. And, you know, it's this, again, very foreboding point in the movie and the plot. And then at the very end of the scene, when she leaves and he's like deep in thought about what's his next move. And the last sound we hear is a foghorn in the background. And then it cuts out. And to me, it was like, I got a chill when I heard the foghorn, just a little touch like that, because it seemed to be just perfect. You know, foghorn sort of expressing the loneliness, kind of what it symbolized, that kind of feeling. So little things like that. And the many, many times there were these little things that just add to the mood, and it helped create it to back up what's going on screen. Oh, like I wanted to also mention the shack, the where he lives. Skip lives in this little shack right off the pier, so it's actually on the water, you know, in the East River, and it's such a perfect metaphor for his being on the outs of society, right? Yes. He's on the edge of society, yeah. And this where he lives is literally on the edge of the city. In fact, yeah. A little bit outside of the city, he's in the water actually. And he has to, and it's like a shaky little shack. You have, there's this very shaky little bridge. That is the only way access to get to into his little shack. And also, do you notice that the sign on the painted on his little shack is bait? Like,
notice that.
Yeah, so he's living in and presumably he's not selling it. It's like it used to be a bait store, and then he's renting it something now. But they still have that little sign on there and bait. And I was thinking, like, I don't know if it was intentional, but I would assume there's some intent in that you know, like he is always like he's throwing out bait, you know, to catch people as a pickpocket. So it's like that seems to fit that the name of his little home is bait, you know.
Yeah, and even that's a good point. I didn't notice that. And in a way, he himself is bait because everyone's going after him.
Right. Yeah. He is the bait.
He's the fish that they need, right, to pull in.
Right.
The cops and the communists and everyone is after this guy, and he's so
he is
sweet.
The bait. You're right. It's more that he's the bait. I was thinking, like, you know, as a pickpocket, he's I was thinking his charm is what he throws out as bait because he has this leering smile and stuff like he see that he throw that in the very first scene at Candy, and that helps him physically to get in proximity, and one assumes that his mode of operating is that, you know, he throws out charm bait to get what he wants. But that's one meaning, but I think the bigger meaning is what you were saying, that he actually is the bait.
Well, he was so wonderful in this, and he had played so many criminals, and he apparently didn't really want to play criminals anymore, but he liked Fuller so much, and he liked the script so much, so he did it. And you may also have read this, that apparently Marilyn Monroe was up for Candy, the Jean Peters part, but he felt that she was too sensual for it, which I think that's maybe true, because not that Marilyn Monroe didn't also have a sweetness and an innocence, but Jean Peters didn't have the same, she was very beautiful, but didn't have that same natural, as sensual as someone like Marilyn Monroe. So I think that she fit that.
Oh, absolutely. Better. Yeah, I think she was just wonderful. She was perfect for it. And I also think Marilyn Monroe, she could have played it, but I think she didn't have the grittiness. I don't see her as, you know, Jean Peters had that perfect combination that she was able to bring to the character of this street smart personality, with still having the sweetness, you know, within her, but that mix, you know, she's, you know, a girl of the streets, and she knows a way around the tough world that she's living in, but she's also got this sweet side, and she, you know, even that she talks with this kind of low class New York accent. She pulls off the whole thing.
She was great. I mean, I'm sort of sometimes curious what Marilyn would have been like, because she, as I'm sure you know, she had a really horrible life too. So maybe that would have been a different side that we didn't see of her in other movies.
If she could have drawn, it would have been interesting to see if she could have drawn from her own sad life to the character, she might have made it work. But it seems like she built her whole image, her public image and screen image around Marilyn Monroe, around countering that background, yes, and ignoring, yeah, it and putting it aside, and being the you know, the sweet, loving, lovable, flirtatious, you know, that thing. But you know, you know, but whether she could have drawn from that within her, that's interesting.
It's hard to say. I mean, yeah, because we certainly saw later on in her career that she got interested in different kind of parts, like the one she did with Montgomery Clift, Clark Gable, the name of it, that Arthur Miller
Misfits.
Wrote. Misfits, yeah, which is really a really different side of her. But that was, you know, almost 10 years later, right? So it's
her last film too, I believe.
I think it was, yeah. It was one of her, if not the last, but one of her. I know it was Clark Gable's last, it's hard to say. But all in all, it's a wonderful film, and I think it was, you know, beautifully casted, beautifully performed by everyone, and highly, highly recommended. Well, Jonathan, thanks again for joining me today to discuss this great noir. Tell Trillo and Suede I said thanks.
I will. Yes. Yeah, it was a lot of fun.
No, absolutely. And for those of you who may be interested, I have a Patreon membership where I have a tier which is dedicated to film noir. So the link is in the description box below, where you can become a member, and the details are there for what I offer in that tier. And there is also an audio version of this podcast, which is available anywhere that you get a podcast, Spotify, Amazon, places like that. And if this is your first time here on my YouTube channel, please consider subscribing. It's absolutely free. By pressing the Robert Bellissimo at the Movies logo, you'll see it right here floating above my head to your top left. Just click on that. And then click the bell in order to get a notification every time I release one of my new videos. Well, Jonathan, thanks again. And we will see everybody soon.
You're welcome.